The setting for the latest in our film series is a bar, a dive bar in Las Vegas. It's one of those places that has its regulars, people who can settle into a stool for hours and pound back drink after drink as the day passes by. The filmmakers, brothers Turner and Bill Ross, describe it as the arc of a drunk. And they've been fascinated by dive bars for a long time now, how strangers with such different backstories create this community when the inhibitions are stripped away by booze. Their interest in bars started a long time ago when an eccentric uncle took them to one, even though they were way too young to go along.
Uncle Dave liked to say that the world is full of dignitaries, luminaries, and notables.
All stars, luminaries, and notables.
And he thought we should have an experience and show us off.
We've got something to say to the zillions of people all around the world.
He would take us to a joint called Scudsy's.
And I've also got something to say to Elizabeth.
We would go for a pay-per-view. I think it was SummerSlam.
Come on, you can do it, Randy.
Come on.
Macho Man Randy Savage married Miss Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, I love you.
Oh, wow. My goodness, he's got it.
It was being billed as the match made in heaven.
Oh, yeah.
So we were really excited because there was cake involved. But
I'm sure we had on wrestling outfits.
Just, you know, from a normal 5 and 7 year old life to go to into a situation like that, it was, you know, we'd go back and tell our buddies and they wouldn't believe anything.
Well,
that we were
that
saying.
Night, we were the dignitaries.
You're just in time for the knot party. We're not having fun.
It began this great fascination with these faces where...
And love of all-stars, luminaries, and notables.
Absolutely. And every time thereafter, you know, we'd be on the school bus driving through town and you'd look at one of those places and you'd realize that something wild was going on with that.
Hey!
Where you at, bro?
Long
time no see. Welcome to the party.
And so those spaces have always been important to us and part of our experience, and that's usually where we start from. It's got to be something that is meaningful to us, that resonates with us, and that, you know, that there may be some things to discover yet about it and why it has so much resonance with us.
Come waltzing Matilda with me.
Don't forget your brown bag full of explosives.
That was so good.
Why do you think that is? What is it that interests you about a bar, about the people inside?
These are places where stories are told and where stories are written.
You can always come to this bar
and feel like family.
And feel like family. You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly. And
where people come to regale an audience.
John Holmes, take his pants off! Right!
Or to sit with themselves. And we've often used that as a starting point of discovery. You know, you pull into a town, you try to find the place where the people are. You know, meet some folks, get the temperature of the room, and that'll tell you a little bit about where you are. And we thought at a moment in time, such as we were in 2016, where it seemed like some discourse was being lost in this country, that might be the perfect time for us to spend time within the four walls of a barroom and just see what folks are saying to each other.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the latest in our film series. It's called Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. It premiered at Sundance this year in the documentary competition, even though it may not technically be a documentary. So let me explain what I mean. And this might be a time to give you a warning, kind of a spoiler alert, because this next part may impact the way you experience this film when we screen it online next Tuesday night. So if you want to go into the experience raw, just wait to listen to this conversation later. Okay. Turner and Bill Ross, the filmmakers, they created this scenario, a plot for a film they wanted to make. and they imagined that it was the last 18 hours of a dive bar in Las Vegas that was going out of business, and all of the regulars would show up over the course of that time to say goodbye to the place. They cast the film, in a way, though it was more street casting than anything. These were real people they found in real bars, though not in Las Vegas, in New Orleans, where they live. They didn't stage anything else. They set up this backstory and they started filming. And those of you who will join us for the screening, you can decide whether they came up with something true. Turner and Bill Ross have directed other documentaries before, and a kind of concert film with David Byrne and Ira Glass called Contemporary Color. In fact, they told us it was that film that dictated the language they used for this one.
We say every time, better in all directions. What did we learn from the last one? How can we expand upon that? What worked? What was interesting? And where can we go with that?
And usually the things that we either failed at or couldn't work into or, you know, got left out in the edit, they carry themselves into the next films as well.
Hmm. I guess I'm surprised when you say that this came out of Contemporary Color, which was, we should mention, just this collaboration with the musician David Byrne. What was it in Contemporary Color that influenced the way you were thinking about this piece?
In the three previous films, we thought about it more like fishing. We were spending long periods of time in places to let them speak to us, almost like reading tarot cards or something. You know, being there with an idea and being open to receive it and letting it dictate its own narrative. So while we might have ideas, you know, say, well, this film is about nostalgia, this film is about ghosts, this film is about mythology and, these sort of deeper ideas that we've got. We created a framework, and then within it, we let it live and breathe until finally we felt like we'd solved the puzzle. But with Contemporary Color, we shot an entire film basically in 4 nights.
Yeah.
And it was the same show every time, but it allowed us to understand the choreography of not only the show, but of the space, and to say, wow, we can, within four walls, in a finite amount of time, we can follow this choreography. We can look for the acute moments that speak to an experience, the experience of being there. And we infused it with characters and with storylines. And, there was a bit of narrativizing going on, even though it is a document of an experience. And so the takeaway was, well, what if we go back to, let's not get bigger with this. Let's get smaller again. Let's go back to the two of us in a room with a well-curated cast of characters in a space that we know, love, and understand, and see if we can't do something in that limited palette with a finite amount of time and just be available to it. That was the gestation of Bloody Nose.
Somebody described what you were doing with the kind of outline and the curation of the narrative in this as a kind of, I liked this, a kind of spiritual itinerary.
Who said that? That's good. I like that.
Yeah, right? I mean, I can't remember who said it. It was one of the reviewers, and it seemed to make a kind of sense for what you were trying to do. So it wasn't a script you were writing necessarily, but you had types in mind. You had...
Absolutely.
You had a setting in mind. Like, let's find a setting where we can extract something authentic, something real, but also let's create some sort of framework for it and just see what happens.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has a lot to do, the bar itself is a major character.
Yeah.
So I love that. I love that spiritual itinerary idea because really, the light of day is as much a character as the participants themselves or the stages of drunkenness or, what any sort of narrative that we might have been after. We had an idea, of a trajectory that might take place. And certainly because we had control of the scenario, it almost acted as a closed set. Mm-hmm. And we knew the comings and goings and we knew every corner of the room. And we had brought in all of these super individuals, all of these archetypes that each had their own license to really take up the space that they inhabited. And that's what we said to everybody. You're here for a reason and there is no duplication. There will be no redundancy here. You are your voice and we love you for that. And that's why you're here. And then it was just a simple framing. We said, this is this this is a place that you understand. You know, you've spent time in these places. We've probably found you in one.
Yeah.
But this place is your place. It's your most important space. And after tonight, it will be gone. And so whatever you choose to do within that is up to you, whomever you choose to bring. That's what you will provide. And so while Bill and I knew what we were looking for, you know, the little embellishments throughout the day and what we needed to capture in order to really fill out the space, once those entrances started happening and the first person stakes their claim and the second person comes in, by the time the third and fourth person comes in, there's already a narrative that's beginning to take place.
Yeah.
And so even if we, you know, as we provided stimuli and sort of curated, you know, how people were arriving and what might be happening, there was no overt direction. We never wanted to break that spell. We wanted that to be a safe harbor so that when they walked in the door, they were themselves until they walked out. This is the narrative that you choose, and these are the dynamics that you create.
It was so theatrical in some ways, I thought, that, you know, a character comes in.
Ricky!
They engage in some stage business. There are some relationships. Some stay and are more a part of the sort of storyline. Others are more fleeting. But there was a deeply theatrical element to it, and it made me wonder if that was something you intended or if that's just the way things play out. Like, theater, good theater anyway, just shows that reality, or if that's a construct of playwrights. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the theater of the people. You know, all the world is a stage. And and a bar is an inherently theatrical space, and I think we all sort of understand the mythology of it. But it does have this wild magic to it. You know, you can walk into a bar in a town that you don't know and meet somebody for an hour and end up telling your whole life story in a way that you wouldn't in any other setting. It would be bizarre. And so it is, you know, it was conducive to that. But, you know, certainly we also thought about it, you know, in our own internal dialogue as, this is a stage. This is our little theater. And even if we're not, you know, bringing in trained actors who understand the theatricality of it, we thought about, you know, framing and composition and how this place might evolve over time. And our references were also theatrical. You know, we think about like the Iceman cometh. Mm-hmm. And we found Michael because he was in a production of Long Day's Journey Into Night.
Wow.
So certainly we had those conversations.
Yeah. One of the things you've talked about, it was interesting, you say that you spend time thinking about what happens at certain times of the day and also what the arc of a drunk, like the arc of that evening when they're drinking. And it did make me wonder what role alcohol played in the course of the evening, because it clearly, as you're watching it, it builds. At first, you have, you know, Pam, for example, and others come in and they're sober and they're reserved. And over the course of time, they get more open, they get louder. In some cases, they get belligerent and sad and reflective. How did you manage to maintain that kind of narrative tension throughout the film?
Great editing.
Good job, Bill.
The way we cast it, you know, these folks know their way around a bar room. And so we, you know, once we wound up the scenario and let it roll, you know, we were really just documenting. And, you know, that's the way it looks over the course of a day. And
a lot of lowering of inhibitions. And
Yep.
But it also made, you know, I mean, we were after authenticity. We were not going to put a bunch of actors and ape, you know, a bender.
Yeah.
We wanted people who understood this life to inhabit that space. And so, yeah, they do, you know, they do have some preliminary, you know, awkwardness and posturing and you know, sort of the day's work. But by the time the night comes in, yeah, I mean, there's bonding, there's feuding, there's nostalgia, you know, waxing nostalgic. There's deep, there's a deep upwelling of emotion, and, you know, veterans holding each other, mm-hmm. and old friends acknowledging each other. And, and generations getting upset with each other. And it was rather magical to watch. You know, because, like we said, we wanted to create a space in which people could have a dialogue and discuss the things that we're really talking about when we're talking about other things. And I think, you know, I think we managed to get to that. And I think people really did have an experience there. You know, when Bruce, the veteran, leaves at the end of the night and is weeping, he really means it. Yeah. But he's crying for a space that only existed for a day.
Right.
It was meaningful enough to him that he mourned the loss of it.
That's Turner and Bill Ross, co-directors of the documentary Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which we're screening next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock as part of our monthly film series with the Utah Film Center. To get the details, go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Public radio brings you vital information and it keeps you company whatever your day looks like, providing moments of levity and joy along with the news. Stay connected at home. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name.
It's easy to hear the news that you trust when you tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. This latest is a film about the last 18 hours of a dive bar in Las Vegas. It's called Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets. It's directed by our guests, the brothers Turner and Bill Ross. Let's talk about some of the characters, and let's go back and talk about Michael, the role that he plays. How do you describe I guess if you were to put this in the terms of a play, he's the main character.
Yeah.
Right? And talk about where you found him. You mentioned that a little bit before. And whether or not did you key on him at first, that I think Michael's going to be the guy that is the framework for the other characters.
Well, we had, like any of our projects, laid out a wish list of types, you know, that we wanted. And Michael's was, you know, this lead that we kind of we kept thinking about the musical Grand Hotel. What's the character's name?
Otto Kringlein.
Right.
Especially played by Michael Jeter in the mid-90s.
But we had seen this thing as kids on TV. And so we kept talking about, you know, this character as this Michael Jeter character. But so, you know, we went out looking for that. And I had remembered that I had seen Michael in, Long Day's Journey and Tonight many years ago. And he always stayed with me. There was something about him. And he seemed perfect for this. And so we,
was he good? Was he good on stage?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a solid actor.
Yeah.
Continues to work. He is a working actor.
So, you know, we approached him with this weird idea and he was into it. And it was fascinating to see him because he's really the only actor in the film. Yeah. It was fascinating to see him prepare for the role, but then also just be, So he was kind of our point guard, our quarterback. You know, we had long conversations with him ahead of time, and he, you know, would dictate sort of the climate of the bar a lot of the time. Mm.
But it happened organically, you know. He'll argue with me about this, the amount of preparation or dictation. He really felt like he feels like he was much more of an inhabitant of the space. But in the lead up to it, we were able to have conversations about Eugene O'Neill, about themes, about, you know, what the arc of this might be. And we were able to tell him, you know, this is something we were inspired by someone who was a fixture in a bar, this Otto Kringlein character, and the world pivots around him.
Yeah.
He's just a sad sap trying to go on his last tear. But everyone's story sort of moves through it in one way or another. And we need somebody like that. We need somebody who can go the distance and have an awareness of what we're after. But at the same time, he was confronted by the actuality of the experience. And, you know, having no words on page and just a loose idea, he really wrestled out this character in real time. And it was a magnificent thing to see.
There's a moment when Michael says, this is early on in the film, I pride myself on not having become an alcoholic until after I was already a failure.
You really hit the ground running today, Michael.
I know we're making fun, but...
Aren't we always?
I pride myself...
People doesn't say what else
we I pride to. Myself on not having become an alcoholic until after I was already a failure.
Okay.
Because alcoholic failures are boring.
That's actually...
And I ruined my life sober, and then I came to you.
Would you tell me about that scene? Just how did that develop? How did that take place? Was it part of a conversation that you were having? Did it happen organically? How did it work?
Yeah, just
Michael's thinking was that he wanted to, you know, we told him, you know, we love you as you are, but you do, you know, you do understand what we're after. And he took that and he said, well, I'm going to be a version of myself. I will be the non-working actor. I will be my worst nightmare, the person who quit, the person who gave up. And I think there was some deep resonance in there, you know, and he was able to really channel that idea. And so he began the day, you know, saying, I'm happy to be here. And, you know, I it's not drink that drove me here. And throughout the course of the evening, you watch him begin to look around the room and assess it differently. You are not, I am not your family. I'm somebody that you drink with at a bar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the end, he's telling Pete, you know, you need to get out of here before you turn out like me. And so that when he departs at the end in such a rush, he's not leaving a place that he loves anymore. He's turning his back on it. And it's just so devastatingly sad because where's he going to go? And has he lost the only thing that that gave him any sort of meaning?
You going to be okay, Robin?
You don't know nothing about me, do you?
Huh?
And there was no setting him up for that. That we were just documenting him going through that. So, you know, when he says those lines early on in the film, that was just a shred of a conversation that we captured, and that's what he brought to the table.
He has such an expressive face. And the way you edited the film, we keep coming back at moments, just times when he's just sitting there taking in kind of the impact of the moment, the import of it all. You can see he's wistful. You can see he's regretful. You can see all of that sort of that, all of those emotions that he must be feeling as a human being, as a person sort of inhabiting a character, playing out just in his face. Like visually, it was incredibly powerful.
God, he's got a great, great face.
Yeah. And, you know, depending on what is happening with the soundtrack at any given time, you can put so many things, you know, in his mind. It was an incredible face to, you know, it made the edit easier.
But he really was going through something, you know, maybe it is the language of the film, and maybe it is his own personal process and this gauntlet that we asked him to run. And he certainly responded.
Where that came through to me almost more powerfully than anything else was a moment, again, this was fairly early on in the film, when I can't remember his name, one of the great bartenders who grabs an acoustic guitar every once in a while and plays.
Mm-hmm. Mark, yeah.
Mark, yes, yeah, sorry. And, yeah. and Mark is singing Crying, the Roy Orbison song. And we see him in, you know, engaging with the others as well, but then you key on Michael, and you key on Michael's face reacting to it through the mirror of the bar.
Right.
Would you talk about that moment too? Just as shooting it, and because I have to say there are a lot of moments like this in the film when what we see happening is playing out in a mirror.
Then I saw you last night, held my hand so tight, as you stopped to say hello. Though you wish me well, you couldn't tell I'd been crying over you, crying over you.
He's almost as good as a jukebox.
That's pretty all right.
Sit so long.
It's not bad at all.
Left me standing.
I missed you guys. I missed
all alone.
I wanted to see you guys before.
Alone and crying.
It's over.
Thank you, sweetie.
Crying.
Enjoy this, you dude.
Crying. Crying. It's hard to understand that the touch of your hand can start me crying.
Feel free to sing along.
I thought that I was over you, but it's true, so true. Cheryl, I love you even more than I did before. But Cheryl, what can I do? You don't love me, and I'll always be.
You can't sing that high right now. Yeah, that's your shot. Why don't you?
Well, what is, you know? What is the more descriptive moment? Do we need a survey of the moment? Is it a moment that we celebrate and we feel joyful, or you know, can Michael's face in that moment speak to something deeper and the actuality of personal experience?
But give yourself some credit. It's a great shot. Looking at him through a cracked mirror, and what with that song? I mean, it says everything about his character right up front in the film. So you did a good job.
I mean, looking across and seeing your reflection and maybe the actuality of what it is. But we had to get creative, you know, within four walls. What are you going to do? It was a real, not only an endurance contest, but, you know, how do you keep that interesting, and what can you direct your attention to that tells the best story? And so, you know, like in the middle of the night when everybody joyfully runs out into the parking lot, and Michael is left alone, all of a sudden you see almost through the eyes of the bar itself. And realizing the emptiness and the loneliness without its inhabitants who give it life. And Michael's almost a ghost in it. And you realize that, you know, the loss of the bar space is not just the loss of a building, but the loss of a community.
One of the things I wondered how you did was we see these really profound, deep conversations. We hear them. We see them and hear them. The way you were able to record the audio of this conversation, which is – it's just like incredibly meaningful, profound conversation. And then the most tawdry, ordinary conversation is happening right next to it down the bar. And you managed to get both of those. And I thought that was – that was really remarkable.
That's what bothers me. We're all paranoid when you get out. There's nobody there. Back, we don't have a home. All our friends moved away, and you spend all that time. There's nobody there. Nobody. And you try to find a job. There's no job. And you sit there and drink that. It doesn't get you where you want to be. And you know what hurts me more than anything is nobody appreciate the service I did, what we did. And there's nowhere to go, there's no house, there's no home. And everybody, when I went and applied for jobs, they told me I was overqualified.
Yeah, overqualified.
Everybody brought it, and they knew what we were up to, and it was really a collective experience. You know, we like to say that we don't shoot at people, but with people. And I think we set up a scenario that was comfortable for everybody, that allowed for, you know, meaningful conversations, but also, you know, BS conversations.
And that's why we didn't exclude ourselves from the film. You know, you see us in there. Yeah. And, you know, in the closing photos taken by the people in the bar, you see, yeah, we were all in this room together. There's no magic at play. They recognized that we were there, and we recognized that they were there. And together we, you know, we created this document.
And even though the illusion of the final film, you know, doesn't, you know, have us sitting at the bar during, you know, over the course of an 18-hour shoot, you know, we'd take a break, sit down with somebody and have a cigarette and just check in with them, see how they were doing. And so it was, we were all in it together. Yeah.
So let's talk about Shay, bartender, yeah. A woman who is, from what I can gather, at least the way she's conveyed in the film, she's a single mother trying to take care of her son as best she can. Her son comes with her. She parks outside and he has a few friends and she's worried about him. She loves him, but she's also a wounded person and trying to do her best.
Trey, come here.
What are you doing?
Chilling out in the alley, eating beef jerky.
I smell your breath.
I told you I'm drinking beef. I'm eating beef jerky.
Don't let me catch you drinking again.
I'm not drinking.
I don't trust you.
I'm eating beef jerky, Mom.
Are you all right?
Mm-hmm.
You know. We won't be here for a little while longer. People think we're already close. Stay out of trouble, okay?
Talk a little bit about the role that she played and that her son played, whose life we see mostly outside of the bar, although not a lot of what happens in this film does take place outside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shay and Trey's relationship, you know, a lot of that was brought into the film. We found Shay, she was a waitress, here in New Orleans. And, I think she mentioned to us that she had a son and we said, well, cool. Can we talk to him as well? Because we knew we needed, or we thought we needed, a few outlets, over the course of a film or over the course of the film to, so the film wasn't so claustrophobic. We were worried that, if we were stuck inside a bar for at least an hour and a half, it might be too much. So, you know, they reflected some of, you know, our experiences from growing up, but also, you know, editorially acted as a release valve.
And we wanted that also evolution of age, you know, the kids outside will eventually come inside and replace that older generation who's on their way out. But, Shay and Trey were very interesting because I think Shay really brought a lot of real experience to the situation and became very much a mother, not only to Trey, but to the bar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her concerns are genuine and Trey's out there just, living his life.
Yeah. I know that, and I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this, but you did do some shooting with Trey and some of his friends. If I have this right, in Las Vegas itself, and the footage you shot with those boys, you couldn't use any or much of it anyway, but it seems like for you, Turner, that was a kind of a that those shots were kind of a treasure or something.
Well, we spent 2 weeks with a bunch of the characters after we had done the majority of the shooting. Mm-hmm. After we had done the principal shoot, we sat down and processed what had happened and thought about the entrances and exits and where people are coming from and where they're going. And then we took that and out into the streets of Vegas and, you know, motel rooms and places, you know, diners. And we did a lot of shooting so that we could have these narratives continue out into the world. And we used little pieces of it, you know, just to give a sense of lives dissipating, moving on, going out. But it was incredible. Like the bar shoot was incredible. You know, these people having real experiences and really inhabiting space. But in the end, it didn't benefit the narrative of the bar, and too many departures really just it drained the life out of it. So again, you know, that's probably something that will filter into the next project that we work on. You know, it's always these the darlings that we have to kill that inspire the next things.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about your relationship, your creative relationship, and the sort of the mandate you set out for each other I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. So, Turner, what is your role in the creative partnership? And, Bill, what is your role? Have you guys, do you have your strengths and weaknesses? Do you have to work around each other and rely on each other's, you know, both parts of those, of that partnership?
Absolutely. We've been brothers our whole lives. And, you know, when we were kids, there was no pressure. If there was something fun we wanted to do, oh, let's make a monster movie. Well, we just figured out how to do it. Oh, I bet I could do the makeup. Oh, I bet I could, you know, play this part. And we've tried to bring that spirit into the films that we make now. You know, when we first started out, we were working within the system of movies. And, you know, while that was very informative, we knew that we didn't really want to work that way. We wanted it to be like it was when we had the freedom to play. And so, in practicality, on the front end, in terms of conceptualizing and getting the production in order, I do more heavy lifting. And on the back end, Bill is the best editor. So,
thanks, buddy.
Yeah. So he is the author on the back end. So we both get to, you know, we both get that sense of authorship. And then in the middle, we work together. We both shoot. We are both present in a shared vision. And sometimes one guy's better for the job than the other, but usually it's a very mutual adventure that we go on, and it's pretty even.
How much of the film, I guess I'll put it this way, the time, I guess you started shooting, if I have this right, the day after the election in 2016.
That's right.
So I guess I'm wondering just what that had to do with anything that was going on in the bar. I mean, a few conversations come up, and I'm guessing there were more that you probably may have taken out. But I guess what I'm wondering is how much of – because it's not a political piece. People barely really talk about that part of it. But I wondered how much of the moment was an important part of the context for it.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't plan it to be the day after. That was a coincidence. But because of the result, people wanted to talk, and emotions were close to the skin no matter which way you felt about things. But people's hearts were on their sleeves and, you know, wanting to discuss. You're right. I mean, there was a lot of conversation about what had just happened, but we didn't want to make that film. That would have really dated it. And I didn't particularly want to make a film about that guy. So,
and it's in there. And certainly, you know, the world that created that scenario is the world that we were sourcing from. But I feel very similar right now to the way that we did approaching this film. We looked at each other and we said, well, you know, what can we do? What can we do right now? And what we do is make films, and what we need to do is get off our ass and go make a really good film and pour ourselves into it.
One review of the film, I think this was in Rolling Stone, raised what seemed to me a pretty relevant question about all of that. And the review said that, what does the term documentary even mean anymore? You know, like, is it journalism? Is it an extension of an art form? Do we need to keep the fiction and the nonfiction lines from being blurred in this time when we have a, you know, reality TV star as president? What do you think about that?
I think it's a time in which we're going to get a lot of interesting art, and certainly we are. We're willing to engage in that conversation.
We're hopeful that there's going to be some interesting.
We are hopeful.
That'd be great. I'm nervous. We might get some other stuff, but
we're going to get a lot of whatever it is. But I don't. You know, for us, it's just. We're not trying to carry the banner of what is documentary and what is not. We don't talk to each other like that. When we have an idea, we go out and figure out how to illustrate it best with each other, and to be a part of our experience, to be within our experience, which I guess then is reflective of the times. And because we go hope for deeper human truths, we end up doing a lot of documenting. But for us, it's just the best way to illustrate the themes and to get into the worlds that we want to be a part of.
I have to say, the times when I was most taken in by the film was when I had no sense of what was going on time-wise.
Time-wise?
Yeah. I knew what time it was, I guess, you know, like, right. Oh, man, it's getting to be 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. Like, I had a sense of that, but like, yeah. I wasn't really. And that is another thing that I wanted to ask you about, because it seems like one of those, maybe a reference point for your sort of visual sensibility is like the 70s kind of vibe. Something about that does come through in, I don't know, just the sense of place that I got from the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those films have always been a reference for us, you know, more of a handmade type film. Our references for this one were The Exiles and Dusty and Sweets McGee and Husbands and more, you know, handmade.
Feel gritty and lived in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And have an atmosphere to them. Yeah. And, you know, so we certainly wanted to pay homage to that and also, you know, create something that, you know, hopefully is timely, but it's not important. What we wanted to achieve was creating something that was without time. You know, it's timeless. It can speak to an experience now, in the past, in the future, and sort of be without the boundaries of, you know, the stipulations of current events.
Mm. You know, one thing I noticed, I'm not sure it was enough to be called a theme in the film, but this idea, this generational conflict came up a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Was that organic? Was that something you had on mind that you maybe prompted a little bit? Because it was one of the most kind of fraught moments in the film. One of the characters who gets, I don't know how much you want to say about this, but really belligerent about what the other generation has done to his generation.
Why are you so mad at me? Everything you say to me is an insult.
You are old.
Yeah.
That's the number one reason. Thank you, darling. The number one reason I'm old, mad at you is because you're old guy.
Right.
And I think your generation destroyed my country. How young is your grandkids?
I don't have grandkids. I don't have kids, I don't have grandkids. I look after old ladies and I clean houses and I contribute to my world and
Now you can blame me generationally as much as you want, and it's appropriate to do so because my generation up. But if you continue to condense
my fighting,
If you continue, shut up, you little punk.
In the casting, I'd say we were hopeful that maybe that would be touched on, but I don't think we knew just how much that was ultimately going to play a part in the.
It was surprising how resonant it was.
I mean, yeah,
we didn't dictate it. We did not provoke the conversations, but like Bill said, by creating the scenario and casting in such a way. You know, we created generational layers. And so, you know,
and probably the election had something to do with that. Or it was like, well,
yeah.
You know,
your generation,
it's the day after, and
this
is what.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. I want to ask about a scene that you referenced earlier. And this is a conversation Michael has with Pete. It's one of the most powerful moments in the film, I think. Pete goes to rouse Michael. He's fallen asleep on the sofa there in the bar and tries to wake him up. And then they have this moment where Michael says, "You got to get out of here. Look at me. I'm not as old as I look."
You have to get up. You have to actually get up.
Okay. I'm getting up.
Okay.
I'm getting up.
You have to get up. I'm not trying to go take a nap.
I know you're helping. Oh, that's better. You're helping me get up. Jesus. I didn't think I was ever going to fall asleep.
You just fell asleep. Now you have to get up.
Stop saying that. I'm awake.
You're awake. We have to get up.
You got to get out of here. You gotta get up.
No. You shut up a second.
All right, what?
You gotta get out of here.
Out of where? This bar?
Yes. How old am I? I don't want to play that game.
45.
Right. Shut up. I'm 58.
That's enough, man.
Shut up. 58, I look like I'm 70. Right? Come on.
What was going on there? Because I want to believe that was very much real for some reason.
Yeah, it was.
I think that's one of the most illustrative points of what we're talking about with Michael. Michael, I know, had some thoughts in his head, some ideas of what, you know, how he fit into that narrative. And he was really observant of Pete. And so that becomes this really wild binary moment where Pete is just interacting with Michael. Michael is interacting with Pete both as an actor and a human being. And he's both being completely sincere and also seems to be aware of a greater purpose with his role in the bar. And it's so bizarre to witness something like that in real time, where you, even as the authors of the experience, you can't quite tell exactly which one's talking. And
it's really one of those moments when you shoot like this, you feel it, you know what's going in the movie, and you just hope to God that you remember to hit record.
Right.
You know, it's such a moment that you're sucked into it. You're almost not shooting. You're just, it feels so alive that you're very, very present.
And, oh, well, there it is. That's there's the thesis right there.
Exactly. So, yeah. So when it was happening, it was, I knew that, we got something here.
The bar that you conceived for the film, mm-hmm. Do places like that still exist?
Yeah, definitely. We scouted, for some time on the outskirts of Vegas and here in New Orleans. And they do. And I just hope they continue to after all this.
I think you could tell this story about a bar in New York in the turn of the century, 1900. I think you could tell this story about a bar in downtown LA in the 70s. I think, certainly people are actually having this experience right now, where their favorite places are closing and those communities are being lost.
What did you guys learn from this experiment, do you think? And what then will you apply to the next one? Like, what's the next step in the evolution if you've been thinking about it that way?
Well, that's what we were talking about right before we got on with you. So
we'll get right back to it when we get off.
But yeah, we are mid conversation with that one, but,
I think it's many things. These films are always somehow an act of catharsis, a processing, an understanding of something that has been important to us, but that we needed to have a deeper understanding of. And then also, as a craft, this is what we do, and we take what we learned from it and try to push it further. And so, ask us in a couple of years, and I'm sure we'll say that this and that were what we took away from Bloody Nose, just in the way that we took things from contemporary color and that became the armature of this idea.
Bill and Turner Ross, again, congratulations and thanks very much for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Bill and Turner Ross. They co-directed the film Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which we are going to be screening for free online next Tuesday night at 7. This is part of our monthly film series with the Utah Film Center. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, @RadioWest. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.